Welcome back to season two of Snubs and Dubs. We're talking about the snubs and dubs of the 87th Academy Award for Best Picture. I'm your host, Kyle Tobiasen, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Miller. Jason, how's it going?
Ooh, it's good. Yeah. How are you doing, Kyle?
I'm doing really good. This is the first time I think we've recorded on a Monday.
This is a weird vibe, yeah. But it's a holiday Monday. Mm-hmm. So on this holiest of Mondays, we're working, we're snubbing and dubbing, we're putting in the hours.
Yep.
Remember this, listener, when you look back at the rocket heights that our podcast will hit, that we were here Monday in the trenches recording an episode.
Well, it's only been a couple days since our last episode. We had to move around our recording dates, but did you watch anything in the last 2 days?
Check this, Kyle. I did.
Oh, shit.
I know. I watched Chip and Dale.
Fuck.
Rescue Rangers?
I wanted to watch that. Dude, I was so close to watching it too.
Kyle, it's good.
I heard it's good.
Yeah. It is a romp. Lighthearted. Fun. Mm-hmm. You're going on an adventure with the Rescue Rangers. They, you know what? It's a good time. I'm not going to actually say any plot details. They're two chipmunks, but I'm thinking they're getting in their chip funks.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of buzz about it. And so I was had no assumptions about it going in. I didn't know anything about these characters other than that they existed at some point in the past. But
yeah. They kind of give you, like, at the very beginning, they do their own rehashing in universe, but it also gets you up to speed enough anyways. So
cool. Yeah, I was so close. I think we almost watched it. It's just we were watching something else. It pushed it a little later than we thought. Because Molly and I finished Demon Slayer season 2, which was the Entertainment District arc, which I've come to learn after the fact.
And how was that arc?
It was better than the first arc, but I still couldn't get fully into it. There's so much happening, which is great. There's a lot of good stuff happening. But I think because it's so episodic, it loses track of how much these characters go through sometimes because it's meant to basically take place over the course of a day or two.
Yeah.
But because it's like 11 episodes, sometimes like a character will get like completely slashed from the chest to the shoulder, and yet they're doing all this crazy shit later and are completely seemingly unaffected by it.
Yeah.
And then they get another injury and they're like, oh, well, that's slowing me down now. I'm like, okay, so that one's slowing you down, but the other one you sustained is not? And it's a bit weird like that, but like very well animated, very kick-ass anime scenes with just flashy lights and swords flaring everywhere, and pretty cool. The last episode didn't wow me because they decided to finish it up in the last like 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the episode was like a flashback giving us the backstory of the bad guys that were just dealt with.
That seems weird.
Yeah.
You would, unless you're Star Wars, normally you do the bad guy backstory first and then you kill them.
Right. And like, I was like, I don't need this context. I just give them a nice little send away and then be done with it because I haven't given a shit about them except for them being an antagonist this entire time. And now you're trying to tell me to care about them
after you've established that they're dead.
Yeah. So it was interesting, but I don't know. I will probably still watch it. There's more arcs ahead, but
Maybe before you do that, you watch a little Rescue Rangers.
I think I will watch
it. I think you should. Rangers. It was enjoyable.
Yeah. I'm kind of annoyed because I have such a busy week. That's why we're recording on Monday, but I will be seeing Top Gun Maverick on Thursday. And so I'll have to report back next episode. So it'll be quite a few weeks by the time that you're hearing my words on it, but lame.
But, you know, we'll get the verdict in.
We'll get it.
I kind of feel like maybe Scientology's onto something. Because if you've seen Tom Cruise, he's not stopping. He hasn't slowed down a little bit. Like, I'm kind of worried they're right.
Yeah, like a new trailer for the next Mission Impossible came out today, too. Mm-hmm. And it looks good.
Yep.
He looks good.
He looks too good, Kyle. I'm kind of worried about that.
All right, well, we'll move on. I just wanted to mention quickly, last episode, I said that Selma didn't win any awards. It actually did win Best Original Song at the 87th Academy Awards. That was just a mistake in my notes. Please forgive me for this grievous error.
No, you got to earn it.
Good for Selma for winning 50% of its nominations.
That's a pretty good ratio, actually.
Yeah. And so, of course, season 2 of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2014. And for episode 17, we're talking about Snowpiercer, which sounds weird because there's some weird stuff going on with this movie where it largely released in 2013. Mm-hmm. And I had this on the schedule for a long time because I was like, okay, we saw it in 2014. I mean, at least I saw it in 2014. They had the US and Canada release in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
But everywhere you look, it says it's a 2013 film.
Correct.
And even on, I think, the box office, it was in 2013.
It was in,
right?
2013.
But then I looked at the list of Academy Award eligible films for the 87th Academy Awards, the ones that we are talking about this season, and it is eligible in this year, but not the previous mm-hmm. year.
Should we just hop into that fact of why? Now that we're already in talking sure, about yeah. that, let's get that out of the way. Let's address that yeah. elephant in the room. So I have a note from the producer here that I'm going to read off, titled, "Likely Why This Is a 2014 Film and Not a 2013 Film." On 9th November 2012, the Weinstein Company acquired the distribution rights to Snowpiercer from CJ Entertainment based on the script and some completed footage, with a plan for wide release in North America as well as throughout the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. It was released in the United States on 27th June 2014 in just 8 theaters in selected cities. This delay was caused by Harvey Weinstein,
gross,
noted terrible human being, possibly not even human being, an owner of the Weinstein Company, noted terrible company, requesting 25 minutes of footage be cut, asking for less dialogue and more action, and a voiceover sequence at the end of the film. The fish gutting scene was one that Weinstein was adamant about removing, but Bong lied to Weinstein, claiming that his father was a fisherman and the scene was in tribute to his father, to get Weinstein to agree to keep it. Actually, Bong was quoted afterwards saying, "My father means not a fucking fisherman."
I fucking love Bong too, though.
Weinstein screened his cut to a test audience of around 250 members. In response to the poor score given by the test audience, Weinstein said to Bong, "You need to cut more." In a later test screening of Bong's original cut of the film, the audience score was much higher. Following the news of a cut, a Free Snowpiercer petition campaign demanding the director's cut of the film be released in the U.S. was created by cinema activist Denise Hurd Basher, with support from the film stars Tilda Swinton and John Hurt. Bong's uncut version of the film was eventually released, but with the caveat that the film switched distributors to Radius TWC, resulting in a limited release in arthouse cinemas. On 3 July 2014, it was announced that thanks to the positive review, Snowpiercer would get a wider US release and play in over 150 theaters. That's the situation, folks. That's what he was battling with in this movie.
Yeah, what a fucking mess. Like,
yeah.
Jeez. I like that his logic, this being Harvey Weinstein, his logic to his cut being worse was to cut more.
Yeah.
What?
That is doubling down. Yeah. That is tripling down. That is not being able to admit you are wrong about a film.
Ugh, yeah. So I'm glad that we had it end up in the state that it is, mm-hmm. which is, I guess, unencumbered. But yeah, what? That's why we're talking about it in this season.
Yes.
And not in a season that would come out later talking about the year previous.
Mm-hmm. So homework has been done. Mm-hmm. We are on the right side of history. Do not argue with us.
But had you seen this before?
I have never seen this before. Honestly, I haven't really heard of this before.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's never really crossed my radar until you started talking about it as an episode for this season.
Yeah, that might be because of how messy it was handled.
Yeah.
Because it had such like a weird handling where when it did eventually get here, it was limited and then eventually mm-hmm. went wide, and the hype might have died down by that point.
It was like a year after it actually released at yeah. that point, because it was August 2013 mm-hmm. that it was released in like Korea and other places around the world. Yeah. And then July of the next year that it actually had a full release in the States and North America.
So weird. But mm-hmm. yeah, I had seen it before. I think I saw it in 2015. I actually don't think I saw it in 2014, but I don't think I've seen it since then.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Well, if you're interested in Snowpiercer or the graphic novel it's based on, I've included the links to the physical media related to it in the show notes. If you buy through that link, it'll help out our show. Or if you have any other Amazon shopping to do, follow the general link to help out our show in the process. A reminder that this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you haven't seen Snowpiercer yet and you want to, go ahead and do so. I've also included the time codes in the show notes so you can skip around to your heart's desire. But without further ado, let's get into it.
Snowpiercer is a post-apocalyptic science fiction action film based on the French graphic climate fiction novel Le Transpersonnage, directed by Bong Joon-ho, written by Bong Joon-ho and Kelly Masterson. This is starring Chris Evans as Curtis, Song Kang-ho as Namgung Min-soo, Tilda Swinton as Mason, Jamie Bell as Edgar, Octavia Spencer as Tanya, John Hurt as Gilliam, Ed Harris as Wilford, and Go Ah-sung as Yona. This has a runtime of 125 minutes and has the messy release information of August 1st, 2013 in Korea, but July 11th, 2014 for a wider release in the States. Kyle, general thoughts. What did you think of Snowpiercer?
I like it. Mm-hmm. It's a good movie.
I really hate to say this, but I thought it was kind of long and they maybe should have cut some dialogue for action. God damn it. I am seething at myself for these thoughts right now.
Yeah, it is like it's one of those films where I was forgetting about it like even the next day. Mm-hmm. And I watched like there's like countless video essays about this movie,
yeah.
Especially after Parasite came out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were making the comparisons because obviously this movie is about class and so is yeah. Parasite. And so they're making those sort of relations and that makes for good content, I guess. But mm-hmm. There's something about it. It does leave an impact, but it doesn't leave a lasting impact.
Yeah. I found the world building in this was so slow. Mm. They really over-explain way too much. Like when they have, like at the very beginning, they have clearly dirty lower class citizens getting counted, herded around, giving protein blocks. And there's like a elite class telling them what to do and a armed force like keeping that peace.
Yeah.
You're kind of good. You can get into action stuff from there, but they spend another 25 to 30 minutes building stuff up with like bringing the kids into this that could have probably just been one scene. You didn't need the scene of, what's the second command's name?
Oh, Edgar. Yeah.
You didn't need the scene of Edgar chasing that kid around. Mm. Didn't do anything and was like a couple minutes long.
Yeah.
Like, at the beginning, it is really slow. And I think they just over-explained some stuff when they could have gotten into it faster.
Yeah. And the thing is like that could have been longer too, because they already start with the fact that like they're going to rebel. Basically, they're planning a revolt. Like it's early in their conversations between Edgar and Curtis that he's like, oh, like things will change when we get to the front. Like things are going to happen soon. And so it definitely could have been longer too, which is a good thing it was so how it was. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do agree that it could have been more effective in its setup.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to get into the little plotty plot?
Sure, I'll get into the little plotty plot. I'm going to read right through the plot. If you don't need the refresher, you can skip to the discussion by following the time codes in the show notes. But here's Snowpiercer. In 2031, 18 years after an attempt to stop global warming via stratospheric aerosol injection catastrophically backfires and creates a new ice age, the remnants of humanity have taken to a self-sustaining circumnavigational train, the Snowpiercer, run by reclusive transportation magnate Wilford. I need a break after that sentence. The passengers on the train are segregated, with the elite and the extravagant in the front cars and the poor crammed into the squillant tail compartments overseen by armed guards. Urged by his father figure Gilliam, Curtis Everett and his second command Edgar lead the tail passengers in a revolt as they realize the guards' weapons have no ammunition. Bullets are believed to be extinct after a previous revolt. They free Nangon Minsu, a captive security specialist who insists on his clairvoyant daughter, Yona, be freed as well. Namgoon helps the tail mob progress forward, but they find themselves facing guards with melee weapons overseen by Minister Mason. During the battle, the train goes into a tunnel, causing total darkness. The guard force, who have night vision, begin picking off the blind rebels. However, the tail sectioners launch a counterattack with torches and push the guards back. Edgar is held hostage, but Curtis abandons him to capture Mason, forcing her to order the remaining guards to surrender while Edgar is fatally stabbed. The tail army stays back, holding the guards captive while Curtis takes Mason, Namgoon, Yona, the skilled fighter Gray, and Tanya and Andrew, two parents who have had their children taken from them, to the front of the train. Curtis's group travels through several opulent cars. Namgoon and Yona recognize the landmark outside and consider that the ice may be thawing. The group reaches a schoolroom where a teacher is indoctrinating the children with Wilford's greatness. A bald man brings eggs to the children to celebrate the 18th circumnavigation of the Earth. The bald man goes to the tail army and shoots them with loaded automatic hidden guns under the eggs, revealing that bullets do still exist. The captured guards are freed, as is Mason's henchman Franco. The teacher, who received a gun from the bald man, kills Andrew before Gray kills her. Franco broadcasts to the classroom his execution of Gilliam. This prompts Curtis to kill Mason. Curtis's group moves on, but Franco catches up with them, killing Gray and Tanya. Franco is seemingly killed by Curtis and Namgoon. The two, along with Yona, continue onward. In the last car before the engine, Namgoon reveals that his collection of the drug Kronal was to use as an explosive to escape the train with Yona, believing that they could survive outside. Curtis stops him as he wants to meet Wilford. Curtis explains that in the early days of the train, 17 years before, the tail section had resorted to cannibalism, and he had been ready to eat the infant Edgar, but Gilliam offered him his arm instead. Curtis wants to face Wilford to ask why he created this closed ecosystem. The engine door opens and Wilford's assistant Claude emerges and wounds Namgoon before inviting Curtis inside. Curtis meets Wilford and, to his shock, learns that he and Gilliam conspired to stage Curtis's rebellion to reduce the tail section's population to sustainable levels. Wilford orders 74% of the tail passengers killed. He then offers Curtis his position leading the train. Curtis appears ready to accept when Yona overpowers Claude, rushes in, and pulls a floorboard up to reveal Andrew and Tanya's children, Andy and Timmy, working the engines as slaves. Appalled, Curtis knocks out Wilford and rescues Timmy from the machinery, though he loses his arm in the process. Curtis gives Yona matches to light the fuse of the chrono, while Namgoon fights and kills Franco, who had followed them along with the partygoers from another car. As the door to the engine room will not close, Curtis and Namgoon use their bodies to protect Yona and Timmy from the blast. The explosion triggers an avalanche that derails and wrecks the train. With Namgoon unresponsive, Yona escapes the wreckage with Timmy. They see a polar bear in the distance, indicating that life does in fact exist outside the train, and the bear looks towards them. But that's where we end Snowpiercer.
Wow.
Well, so there's a plot twist.
Oh.
Did you expect it?
The plot twist of?
That Gilliam and Wilford were working together.
I mean, not really, but I didn't think it was the biggest plot twist in the world either. Yeah. Like, I wasn't shocked by it, especially when you think back of when Gilliam tells
Curtis,
yeah, to cut the tongue out of Wilford.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, so he just doesn't want him to listen to this guy. Yeah. So as soon as he revealed that, I'm like, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is like looking back, because I had seen it before and I did know, and I was watching these video essays before, so I had a quick refresh of the plot twist, but like you can see those little pieces pop up in the beginning, but Gilliam doesn't seem like that big of a presence in my opinion in this movie.
No, he doesn't really weigh in that much.
No.
You kind of come to him as he's passing over the leadership to Curtis anyways. So it's not like he was this infallible figure that was cut short or anything. It was like, it was his time to go. He gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's revealed that he was also part of the controlling party anyways.
Yeah. I feel like this would have hit harder. And I know there actually is a series of this, but like if there was more time with these characters, because then you would have built up that relationship, and that twist would have hurt Curtis a lot more and the audience a lot more when you realize that this whole time he's been working towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it does affect Curtis. Like he goes kind of completely numb to the fact that, you know, all he's been working for has been orchestrated.
Yeah.
But I just think there wasn't enough build up in that to make it truly impactful and like so much of a wow moment.
Yeah. Like all the time that they put into world building probably should have gone into more character development.
Yeah.
Because even Curtis's character, I really didn't care that much about. Like he's kind of the bland, like straight man.
Yeah.
That doesn't have a whole lot of emotion behind him. But when he had that monologue about like eating the baby and people cutting their arms off, the writing felt like too edgy to really actually hit. And I found like it kind of took me out of it because it's like, I realized that babies taste the most delicious. Like, that's not really that. Like that's over the top, edgy to unbelievable the way he's conveying it. It doesn't really seem that sad about it. And now I'm kind of worried he's thinking about baby meat again.
I would not want to be in that room when everyone was cutting their arm off to give
Jesus
Evans a nice meal so he wouldn't eat a baby. Oh my God. Can you imagine just being surrounded by people just hacking off a limb?
Oh God.
127 hours times 10.
Yeah. That is absolutely brutal. I also kind of wonder, like, normally with these class disparities, you have like the lowest class doing a lot of manual labor.
Yeah.
Did they?
No. I don't think they did any labor.
No.
Except for that one guy that was like doing the protein bars, and then they would randomly select like people to do like entertainment acts.
Yeah.
So like you'd think that there would be more work to be done, but I guess if the train is so self-sustaining that it does not need any workers, then I guess it makes sense why they're useless basically, but
yeah. I don't know. It's like, why even bother having them around for anything if they're just, I guess they create,
I mean, that was the idea. Why
children?
Them around?
Yeah.
Yeah, true. Why they create the children for child labor until they're too big to do child labor?
Yeah. Like, I feel like this metaphor for class divide kind of got too nitty-gritty specific to really heavily apply it, because both, you figured out right away that, like, oh, this is about class. There's the front and the back end of the train. This is the revolution to overturn the keys of power. And then you find out that, oh, unless you completely overthrow the system, like, you just change the person doing the hierarchy.
Yeah.
But also, like, we lose some of like the labor disputes if no one actually has to work. So why is there a class divide?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a statement on capitalism, that no one actually has to work. I don't know. Like, it just kind of got overplayed to the point of like not being a very clever metaphor.
Yeah. And it's not like a hidden metaphor.
No, it's very out and about.
It's very literal. Yeah. Like, you're moving from the back of a train in a linear line upwards, and it gets more extravagant as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And like the way that they conveyed information, especially about like some of the history, through Tilda Swinton's Mason.
Yeah.
Like, the only reason that I knew that they were in this class divide, even when there's no labor, was, I guess, because when the train first left, that was the position that each person was in.
Yeah.
So 17 years ago, people were in this position. And now, even though there's no economy, they're still in this same position.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. But that's not to say I didn't enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I did like the movie, and I liked the set design. Obviously, was great. Like, it was each really train cool. car was really well designed, and I'm sure they did most of it, if not all of it, practically as like a set.
Yeah,
because you only have to design like kind of an enclosed car. But
exactly, there was an exact number of train cars were built, but it was like 11 or 12 train cars were built for this.
Nice,
which seems about right. Yeah. And like, yeah, that's a lot of effort put into this, and you can also kind of, because it's set on a train and it's a pretty small set, you get the chance to make really cool production sets and like have a really good design go into it. Think about all the small details, because it's a pretty confined shooting space. So you're able to kind of make it come to life a bit more.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I did find that some of the selections of the cars were so weird. Like, we never saw any like living quarters.
No, but we had a drug car.
Yeah.
We had a drug den.
The fact that you had to like walk through the like the drug car if you were in the front or sections to get to the pool or to the school. Like,
yeah, you had to go through the drug one to get to class.
that's wild. So I think they obviously skipped some cars to just kind of show the more extravagant ones. But like, yeah, that was what stood out to me. Where are people living?
I don't know. Like, you'd think that would be a large portion, especially if the front trainers probably have fairly luxurious places to stay. And there seem to still be a lot of them. Like, on that scene of Nam fighting them on the bridge, there's still a lot of front cars hanging around.
Where does Wilford sleep?
I guess on the floor. Maybe there's like a bed pulls out. You see some cabinets on the side, maybe.
That's probably it. But
yeah.
Wow.
What did you think of the fight sequences?
Pretty cool. Yeah, I liked how they shot them. There was like some kind of slow-mo, almost Michael Bay type shots, in especially when they were doing the big melee fights. But for the most part, like, it was pretty good. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I thought the shot of the people running with the fire up to the fight, that was really cool. I really enjoyed that shot. I found they kind of had a little bit confusing choreography, because it looks like in between fights, when the armies are like looking at each other, it's really close quarters. There's not a lot of space to move. And then when they start fighting, suddenly everyone has enough space to move around and start fighting with other people. So like, I think space wise, it was a little confusing, but I really enjoyed like the setups of the battles and the concepts at work, where it's just two armies face off, like four men abreast at best, just like rushing into each other fighting and not a lot of room. So it's just lines going down.
Yeah.
I thought that was like a really cool concept.
Mm-hmm.
Even though like I thought the execution was maybe not like as tight, but also maybe they looked at making it with that many people in that confined of a space and it just sucked, because it could have. It's probably really hard to like show that.
Yeah, for sure. Especially, because you see like how many people are on opposite sides, and then eventually they just randomly have space. So I guess it's like one of those things where they're just waiting their turn at the end.
And I felt like the graphic level of it was really good, where it felt brutal, but they didn't need to like overly display violence happening.
Yeah.
Like, it was just the scenario that's set up of these dudes hacking the like the revolutionaries to bits, even though it's mostly off screen. Like, it still felt bad. And you're like, you really sympathize with these people trying to rise up and then just getting met with hatchets soaked in fish blood.
Yeah.
When his dad's not even a fisherman. Like, what? What was the point?
That teacher was like so I mean, it's well acted, but she was so creepy.
Yeah.
I loved when she's singing and there's this one shot of it swinging around her face and her just like eye twitches weirdly.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is going on?
Killed that performance. That was really good.
Yeah. Who stood out to you in this movie, if anybody?
I felt that Song Kang-ho as Nam-gun.
Yeah.
He was really good. I really enjoyed his performance. Same with Yona. I think they're both two really good and interesting characters that help move along.
Yeah.
Curtis was in.
Yeah.
He was fine.
It's interesting because like a lot of people say that this is one of Chris Evans's more nuanced performances, which is true when you compare it to like Captain America, who doesn't get this kind of like emotional range as much.
Yeah.
But like he still is kind of like a stoic character, mm-hmm. even though like Curtis is like, oh, I ate a baby and he's trying to like cry or something.
Yeah.
But then most of the time he's just kind of like stern looking and determined. And, you know, I'm not a leader, but I kind of am a leader, but yeah.
Yeah. Like it's the kind of thing he does a lot. And I didn't feel like it was particularly that much better than any other time he's done it.
Yeah. That's not to say like he didn't fit the role, I guess. Like,
no, he was a good call for it. It's just like, that's what the role is.
Mm-hmm. Tilda Swinton was good too. And
I was
like,
about to say, okay. Tilda Swinton was really good.
You can't miss with Tilda Swinton though. Like she always delivers and like she needed to be like creepy and just like so in with her beliefs that like it's gross, but it just worked really well.
Oh, you immediately want to see her get punched in the face for being some rich capitalist jerk. Because she's just, when she comes, I thought, okay, when you're first introduced to her character, when that dude's arm is being stuck out the train, I thought that was a really cool idea for like a punishment. But the whole time I was watching it, I'm like, oh, please don't enter a tunnel. Oh God. And they don't. He just freezes his arm and gets it smashed off.
And see, like, I thought that people were losing their arms and legs because of this.
Yeah, me too.
And it's not until later when Curtis says, oh, a lot of people cut off their arms so that they could eat mm-hmm. that I realized that that was the case.
Yeah.
And then Curtis also says, like, how can I be a leader with two good arms? And when he first said that, I thought he meant, oh, he didn't put up enough action or resistance to have his arm like frozen off.
Yeah.
But later it just means that he didn't give up his arm so somebody could eat it.
Yeah. Which like, I think either way, no matter which it would have been, kind of convey the same point anyways. Like he wasn't willing to do enough for his people to have like given up part of himself.
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, it's just interesting.
It is. Yeah. Well, do you want to roll along into some reviews?
Sure. Oh, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Surely other scientists would have known the effects that this climate changing gas would have had.
Yeah, you think so, hey? Maybe they should have painted this as like Earth's last chance or something. Yeah. Maybe that's the point in the original that like they don't know for sure this is going to work, but everyone's dying from heat stroke anyway, so let's give it a go.
Yeah, because like was Wilford just like the one radical nonconformist who was like, no, like we're just gonna do the train, this gas ain't gonna work, and then he just I guess is proven right. But like how did all the countries of the world come together for a gas that would like freeze the planet? How was not enough testing done?
Okay, well I got some theories here.
Okay.
All of these are not based in the actual universe that this movie came from, because someone wrote a graphic novel and I did not read it. But what I imagine is propaganda plays really heavily into making people believe in the train.
Yeah.
I bet there are other places and the train just doesn't want you to know that. So they make it sound like this is the only place where humanity exists. Yeah. I bet you there's other places where there are people.
Oh, for sure. It's like probably like a bunker or something underground.
Exactly. Yeah. I also feel like you maybe don't need all the world to sign off on doing something. If it's being launched from the States, you probably just need a couple rich enough guys and they'll just do it anyways.
Yeah,
I don't think a lot of people are going to be able to stop him even if money. So
true, good point. Yeah, and like, did Wilford have enough foresight that he knew that the Earth was going to freeze over? So that's why he made the water system suck in ice from the front.
Maybe like, that was like added after or while it was happening.
Yeah, because like, I mean, it seems to have happened in an instant, basically, because there's people standing around just waiting for like a train. We go by them and they're just standing there. You see the frozen
figures
of them. Yeah. Well, there's the people that also went out to try and like rebel and leave the train, and they froze over instantly. And so like, I feel like it was almost in an instant.
Yeah,
that
maybe
this change happened, which meant that Wilford would have had to have known ahead of time.
Well, I guess if he didn't believe that the chemical was going to work, maybe he could see that one coming and just made the right move and had it be ice fed.
Yeah.
Or it did take a month before they got protein bars. So maybe in that time they were doing modifications of the train.
True, true. Good point. Yeah. Interesting.
To say. Well, do you want to hit reviews?
Let's hit the reviews.
All righty. So what do you think the good people of Rotten Tomatoes are giving this, critics and audiences?
I'm going to say like high 70s for critics, like 79, and then maybe like maybe an 80 for audiences, 88, 85.
Bit of a miss. This is a critics movie.
Is it? That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Rotten Tomatoes, the critics gave this a 94 and the audiences gave this a 72. This came in very high reviewed from the critics.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of makes sense. It is like a big class metaphor movie. So critics would probably be like, nom, 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 nom.
You're eating it up. IMDb 7.1, Metacritic 84.
That's so pretty good.
Keeping on with that disparity.
Wow.
At the box office, this made $87 million on a budget of $40 million.
So only doubled, but only doubled. I feel like there were some barriers in place.
There was some bullshit going on here. At the box office, this was number 81 in 2013, would have been 87 in 2014.
Hmm.
But now it's time for our scores, and I did not have the spreadsheet open beforehand, so I'm opening that right now and filling the dead air in between by saying what I'm doing. Kyle, what would you like to give this for your entertainment score?
I'm going to give it a 3.5 in enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I myself am going to be sliding this down a 3 for my entertainment, or enjoyment, I guess I should.
Yeah.
They both start with E, they're close enough. What are you throwing down for craft?
I put it a 4 because I thought it was very well crafted, well directed. Set design was good. Score was good. Costumes good. So, solid 4.
I'm going to give this a 3.5 because I enjoyed it, but didn't feel blown away.
That's fair.
Mm-hmm. I did like that head train room. The engine room with Wilfred in there. That was a cool room. Yeah. I like the spinning gears and the slave children. Kyle, what are you going to give this for your execution?
I give it a 3.5. I think it was pretty well written for the most part and competently acted. Not a lot shown through, but effective in its entire package.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little harsh on this one. I'm going 2.5. Mm. I felt the writing didn't quite hit. They spend a lot of time building up like things happening in the world.
Yeah.
They spend a lot of time introducing names and places and things and people that in a kind of boring way. And I felt that there were some good performances. But other than Tilda Swinton and that teacher were the only roles that were like, wow, that's a really good performance. And those are both small characters. So I wasn't blown. Mm-hmm. This was kind of a 2.5er for me.
Sure.
What are you hitting this for your rewatchability?
I give this a 3 because I feel like I will rewatch this at some point, but currently not urgently going out to do so. And I would also recommend it to people. I think it's worth a check out.
But, oh, yeah.
Especially because it was underseen.
Yes.
So, yeah, 3.
Yeah. Anyone who is a fan of Bong Joon-ho should be checking this one out as one of his works. I agree with you on that. I'm also giving it a 3. I'm willing to watch it again.
Sure.
I'd be interested to not running out to do so.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Kyle, that's going to bring your score to a 14 out of 20 for a 70%. And I'm giving this a 12 out of 20 for a 60%.
Hmm.
Which will bring us down to ranking time. Kyle, would you like me to read off your rankings?
Yes, please.
All right. Top to bottom, we have Grand Budapest, Paddington, Captain America, Guardians, Dawn of the Planet of the Interstellar, Gone Girl, Nightcrawler, Lego, Selma, John Wick, Boyhood, Babadook, Imitation Game, Big Hero 6, Foxcatcher, and American Sniper. Where are you sliding in a little Snowpiercer?
I think I'm sliding it... Oh, I wrote something different, but I think I'm going under Boyhood above Babadook.
Uh-huh. That is going to make this be your number 13 for the year so far. To read mine down, we have Grand Budapest, Paddington, Dawn, Interstellar, Gone Girl, Nightcrawler, John Wick, Selma, Guardians, Lego, Babadook, Captain America, Boyhood, Big Hero 6, Imitation Game, Foxcatcher, American Sniper. I think I'm going to slide this in below Captain America, above Boyhood, to be my number 13 as well.
Yeah.
You're going to agree on that one. And I'm keeping my Chris Evans together. All right. That is going to roll us into some fun Letterboxd reviews.
Oh, boy.
This has a 3.7 out of 5 on Letterboxd. I feel like every movie that we go over is either 3.5 to 3.8. Like they're all exactly in that range.
Yep.
All right. This was a, there were some good reviews for this one. So we got a couple high, a couple low. We're going to start with Matt Singer, 4.5 stars. this is the best Captain America movie of the year. Zinger.
Incorrect.
Yeah, I put this one below Captain. Like, even I was pretty harsh on Winter Soldier and I put this one lower.
Yeah.
Oppie, 4.5 stars. Bro, if Tilda Swinton told you to be a shoe, you be a shoe. There were a lot of Tilda Swinton comments of varying intentions in the review, which is kind of something when you look at that character, because they took like 2 hours to do her makeup to make her be Tilda Swinton. And people were still getting down and dirty in the comments.
Man, Tilda Swinton doing the weirdest stuff, but love it every time.
I know. I'm just so happy for her. She gets to be like a weird little character in every movie. And she does a great job every time.
Yep.
All right, we're going to go down to some lower reviews to balance us out here. Lost in Sea, 0.5 stars. I hate this movie more than I hate myself.
Oh, no.
Buddy, it's okay. Also, maybe you have a pretty high self-esteem then, because this wasn't that bad of a movie.
Yeah.
Maybe you're doing okay, actually. Lars, and this is the last one. There were some pretty brutal reviews in the 0.5 star range.
Oh, wow.
People didn't have a lot to say, but they hated the movie. This one, I think, summed up a lot of the vitriol in the 0.5 stars. Lars, hate to do this to my man, Bong Joon-ho, but this film fucking sucked, asshole.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Ah, fuck.
There was a varying degree. There wasn't a lot of five. I think people kind of tapped out at 4.5. But that makes sense.
Yeah, that's kind of fair. I think this is an easy movie to like, but maybe not love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel you there. So as we said, this was a 2014 Academy Awards eligible movie. Kyle, what do you think it got at those Academy Awards?
I'm going to say nothing, because it probably had a lot of mix up. Even though it was eligible here, I don't think anyone saw it.
Yeah, you would be correct.
Yeah.
It was technically eligible. I don't know if there was anything I would particularly give it.
Yeah.
If it showed up on production design, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then I'd probably move on from there. So it didn't really get that. For other notable awards, there still wasn't really a whole lot. However, it did win Best Director at the Asia Pacific Film Festival for Bong Joon-ho.
I mean, he is one of the best directors.
Exactly.
So
he's a well-decorated director, and he has deserved it.
I mean, I feel like Parasite might have done a disservice to everything else he's made, because now everyone's going to compare that to everything else he's made.
Yeah.
And Parasite is just on another plane of being a great movie.
I still haven't seen it.
What the fuck? Okay, well, maybe watch his other movies first, then watch Parasite, because Parasite, fuck.
Leave that one for last. Yeah. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Are you ready for some fun facts?
Oh, him with them fun facts.
There was no additional lighting used while filming the torchlight fight scene.
Oh.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Which I think that's why some of the shots stuck with me, because it looked natural. And maybe it was. That was just fire.
Cool.
Writer and director Bong Joon-ho explained that the protein block was made by combining seaweed, tangle, sugar, and gelatin. Jamie Bell hated it. Well, Tilda Swinton kind of liked it. Again, she just likes to play creepy little characters, because maybe she's a little weirdo in there, too.
I loved how she ate it when they were eating sushi.
Yeah.
The expressions on her face were so funny.
Mm-hmm. And did you know she was faking that? Because she kind of liked it. According to the filmmakers, trained babies like Yona developed animalistic hearing skills. So it wasn't necessarily clairvoyance. She could just hear through the walls because she's good at hearing. But they never fully reveal if she was clairvoyant. This was just like an added detail after the fact. So maybe it's a little A, maybe it's a little B. Maybe she had just trained her hearing. Bong Joon-ho first wrote the part of Mason with John C. Reilly in mind, but then adapted the character for Tilda Swinton, though he intentionally left lines of Mason being referred to in the masculine form in the script, which show up in the movie. And I had noticed that once or twice and was kind of confused by it.
Yeah.
But it's because he didn't cast someone else.
I mean, I think Tilda Swinton is the right choice.
Yeah.
I mean, she's mostly the right choice for any roles she's in. John C. Reilly might have added a bit of goof to
this. He would have been way too goofy. I wouldn't have taken it seriously.
Yeah.
I feel bad for him, because I'm sure he has other acting chops.
Oh,
but
yeah.
He's just a comical looking guy. The drawings in the tail section of Snowpiercer were illustrated by Jean-Marc Rocher, the original comic artist of the graphic novel Le Transpersonnaire G. I had it on the first one, lost it on the second pretty hard. I'm not fixing that. And lastly, In the post-credit scene of The Avengers, where all the characters were in the shawarma restaurant, Chris Evans was the only one who wasn't touching his food and covered his face with his hand. This is because he was growing his beard out for the role in this film.
I actually knew that, but not, I didn't know that it was related to this film. I just knew that he, because they filmed it so late,
yeah,
like The Avengers had premiered, I think, or was about to premiere by the time they filmed this scene.
Oh.
And so they just wanted to add another post-credit scene.
Mm-hmm.
And because Chris Evans had grown his face out, I think he was covering his face and he had prosthetic on.
Oh, yeah.
So that the prosthetic looked bad because he rushed it.
But clearly, yeah. I'm in a similar boat. I knew that he had covered his face in that post-credit scene because he's growing his beard out for another film. Also didn't know it was this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fun. Well,
that's going to bring us to the end of fun facts here. Kyle, do you have any last thoughts for Snowpiercer?
No, I think I'm done with it.
Yeah, I think I am too.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you all for listening to season 2, episode 17 of Snubs and Dubs. As always, you can find us everywhere on social media at Snubs and Dubs. That's on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd, etc. We're also on Good Pods, so make sure to check us out there and join our official Discord. We'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on Snowpiercer or on this episode, so please send us a tweet or a message with a question, recommendation, or anything else. I'm also at Kyle Tobiasen on Twitter, and Jason is at Wendy_Mills. Of course, all of those links are in the show notes. Make sure to leave a 5-star review and share the show to everyone you know before coming back for another episode. Here is a sneak peek of the film we're going to talk about.
When you get 3 vampires in a flat, obviously there's going to be a lot of tension.
Viago was an 18th century dandy.
Look, a ghost cop.
Vladislav is a bit of a pervert.
This is my torture chamber.
Deacon's like the young bad boy of the group.
I'm supposed to pay rent, but I don't.
That's right. Next time we're talking about What We Do in the Shadows. So make sure to watch it before next episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap. Bye.
Bye for now.